You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. My name is John Malkin, and the name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. You can hear this show every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. This program is dedicated to exploring social change and spirituality, and you can hear this show right here on 101.1 FM in Santa Cruz and freakradio.org on the internet. Free Radio Santa Cruz is commercial-free, collectively run, and has been operating without a license from the U.S. government since 1995. This program, The Great Leap Forward, has been broadcast on Free Radio Santa Cruz since 1997. My very special guest this evening on the telephone is Krishnakant Shukla. He is on tour in the United States from Varanasi, India. And Krishnakant Shukla gave up his job as assistant professor of astronomy at an American college. He was teaching physics and astronomy in New York. And he decided to take off and return to India to follow his heart and study Indian classical music. He had already studied with Ustad Ali Akbar Khan and others, and in 1994 he went back to India, and he sings the songs of Kabir, Goraknath, and other bhakti poet saints. And like I mentioned, he's touring around the United States singing those songs. And Krishnakant Shukla, I'd like to warmly welcome you to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you on the show. And it's so interesting reading a bit about you and your life. And you were devoted to studying physics and science for some time. And you're kind of bringing science into spirituality now, along with music, and you've developed something that you call spiritual ecology, and I'd love to hear a bit about that. And firstly, why don't you tell me about this shift that happened in your life when you had been teaching physics and astronomy, and then you decided to focus on music?
Oh, okay. Actually, when I was a graduate student in physics, I had to spend many hours on the computer doing, difficult calculations, because my work was theoretical, not experimental. I worked in the area, general area of solid-state physics, and I would sometimes spend, maybe 10 hours doing these deep, mathematical calculations. And so initially, my engagement with music, which is something I've always loved ever since childhood, I've had a strong reaction to music. It was something that I really, really loved, but I never considered it as as a career. It was a very deeply loved hobby. But I found that music would balance my all the energy would go into the head from all the physics and the math, and then I felt I needed to do something to feel that I have a body and that I'm the body is also alive, not just the head. So I started, practicing music, and I started actually taking lessons from a teacher in Toronto. And slowly, it's been a slow affair. I never really remember a day when I took a decision that I would, give up physics and become a musician. It's just a slow process that, and it's still ongoing, And sometimes I find when people ask me why you gave up physics to do music, I find that I'm giving different answers on different occasions. So I realized that I haven't really analyzed it. And part of the reason is that when you analyze something too much, you tend to kill it, you know. So anyway, there are many reasons, but basic reason is the most honest answer I can give is I was just following my heart. And the deeper I went into physics, the more, somehow the more musical I began. You know, I became more musically sensitive. I started having more and more realizations, and I really didn't understand why this was happening until many, many years ago when somebody told me that scientists in the West have discovered that the firing patterns of the neurons in the brain for mathematics and for music are identical. So how I understood this statement is that the deep core of the brain, which, you know, when it tries to perceive the harmony and the symmetry in nature, we can do that through physics and mathematics, because in essence, physics and mathematics is the study of the symmetries and the harmonies that exist in nature. So you can either do that through numbers and equations, or you can also do it through music, because music in its essence is also, you know, mathematical ratios and beautiful harmonies and symmetries. So as far as the deep inner brain is concerned, it sees both these activities as the same thing. That may be a reason why, you know, many of the best physicists that who were my, you know, ideals, like Richard Feynman and Einstein, they were also musicians, you know, good musicians.
And they were also so devoted to finding beauty and truth in the world.
Yes, yes. That is another beautiful thing about physics. If you really do physics sincerely and you're not doing it just to have a career and to raise your standard of living, then if you're really interested, then it, and you take it to the end, then it tends to sort of push you into the mystical realm, into the spiritual realm, because there are a lot of things about fundamental physics that are very tenuous, you know, and which raise some very, very fundamental questions about the nature of reality and nature of life itself, you know. And the, in fact, there is a question mark about there being an objective reality at all, you know. I mean, the latest discoveries in physics will, if you, you know, engage in those, you realize that it's virtually impossible to speak of a world existing outside the observer. Now, interestingly enough, because of my background from Varanasi, India, I was aware of the fact that the Indian rishis, particularly Vashisht, who wrote this key text called Yoga Vashishta, they, I mean, 8,000 years ago, they said the same thing, that, you know, there is no reality outside of the mind, you know. So there is, you know, some convergence between the Eastern, you know, mystical traditions, particularly from India, and some of the latest discoveries in physics. So that's where my, you know, my involvement with the, what would be perceived by as mysticism, it comes actually from physics, and also to a large extent from my background from being from Varanasi, from, you know, a family of academics. So, yeah.
Yeah, this is very interesting to me, Krishnakant, the way that some spiritual traditions, well, actually the way that science is catching up with the teachings of some spiritual traditions and seeing that things are not the way that they seem necessarily, and that the material world isn't as solid as we had thought. And every time scientists and physicists find the smallest components that make up material things, they then find even smaller and smaller, and it keeps going on and on and on.
Yes. You know, I realize that lately I've seen that there's a lot of writing, a lot of books have come out about, you know, the mystical aspect of physics and the spiritual aspect of physics. But to be, you know, objective and fair, I should say that a lot of these things are sort of, you know, pseudoscience, actually, in many ways. And physics, in essence, you know, is there are some deep flaws in the very roots of physics in particular and Western science in general. And because of these handicaps which exist at the very roots of Western science, the best that it can do, this is my experience, and this is what I believe, that physics, the best that it can do is to take you to the shadow of the truth. But it can never, physics by itself, and I think any Western scientific discipline, can never make you stand face to face with the truth. And the reason for that is that physics is a theology of matter, you know. As you very rightly said, you know, they find the small particle and then they find one smaller than that. One of my, one of the thought experiments that I did, you know, this is something I learned from Einstein. He was very good at doing thought experiments, you know. If you come to my hometown in the city of Varanasi, India, you would see at the crack of dawn, you would see many people, especially the sadhus, the holy men and women of India. You would see them waist deep, standing in the Ganga, you know, in the river Ganga, and waiting for the sun to rise. And when the sun rises, they are, you know, offering prayers and offering a loving gift of the Ganges water to the sun, and they are worshiping the sun. So in my thought experiment, I imagine that I'm standing there with a typical modern physicist, and I ask this physicist, you know, he or she, would you get in waist deep into the water and sort of bow down to the sun? Would you worship the sun? And the physicist would most likely, from my experience, you know, in academia, most likely he would say, no, this is a matter of faith, and I would not bow down to the sun, you know. And then I would ask him, okay, can you explain to me why you wouldn't do that? And the physicist would most likely say that the sun is a dead ball of gas. It's hydrogen and helium with thermonuclear fusion going on inside it. And, you know, it's very hot. And I'm not in the mood to bow down to a very hot, dead, big ball of gas. That's what the sun is. But then I would question him a little bit further on this. And I would say, you know, what exactly is hydrogen? Because, you know, helium, I mean, you're saying the sun is hydrogen and helium, but basically it's hydrogen, right? Because helium is just two atoms of hydrogen. So what we're really talking about is hydrogen. So what is hydrogen? He would say, well, it's a proton with an electron revolving around it. And now theoretical physicists know that there is nobody alive who has actually ever seen a proton or an electron. You know, these are just ideas in our heads. What we see in the lab is a track in a bubble chamber, or a diffraction pattern, which is like some shadows on a photographic plate, or we see a needle on a dial, or some digital counter going click, 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 you know. And then these are the only things that we see in the lab. And then there are about 10,000 pages of theory and calculations and equations because of which we say that an electron went by, you know, or a proton went by. So there is nobody who has actually seen these things, but let's assume that this, for the sake of argument, that this proton and this electron is exactly as this physicist is saying it is. Then if we go further, then we say, what is the proton made of? Well, it's quarks and subquarks and neutrinos and gluons, etc., you know, subatomic particles. And then you say, well, what are these made of? And then, well, one of the contending theories for the grand unified theory is the string theory. So now you can say the God particle, or the ultimate material particle from which it has yet to be proved, of course, but the particle from which everything is made, you know, the you and I and this telephone and the internet and our mothers and fathers and the people we love, everything is made from these strings, which are quiggly little particles hanging around in 10-dimensional space, you know. So, well, then you ask him, well, what is the string made of? And he would say, I don't know, you know. So you see, ultimately, when you really take it to the end, matter is a mystery. The physicist is taught to believe, or brainwashed into believing, or he has chosen to believe. It is a leap of faith. He believes, it's very much like a religious belief, that the sun is a dead ball of gas, without really knowing or being able to explain what that really means. Now, the people who are bowing down to the sun, these sadhus, they would say, say that, well, you know, the sun has awareness. It has consciousness. He's a being, you know, because the supreme principle of creation is consciousness, not this dead matter. And he would say that, well, just because you are made up of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, but that's not all there is to it. There is a personality living there. You know, in this material body of yours, there is a being, there is a personality. Similarly, in that material body of the sun, which you are calling hydrogen and helium, there is a being, there is an awareness, an intense, you know, a very huge awareness, which is capable of actually recognizing me and giving me guidance and, you know, intelligence and protection and wisdom and so on. So these are two different worldviews, and it was through thought experiments that I, through this, you know, that I realized that basically the at the heart of scientific materialism is basically, you know, this theology of matter, and it's full of religious-like, you know, leaps of faith. As if you study science, you realize that there is nothing in all of physics to explain life, to explain biology. It's just a leap of faith, you know, to say that we are built up of electrons, protons, and neutrons, and that's all there is to it. And then there is nothing in all of biology to explain psychology. There is, you know, it's just a leap of faith to say that the mind is an epiphenomenon of the brain. This is very much like a religious faith. You know, there is no instrument that scientists have devised that they can stick to your forehead and measure a thought and prove that a thought just went by, you know. So similarly, there is nothing in all of psychology to explain the spiritual urge, you know, the superconscious, etc. So from all these deliberations, you know, I realized that if you are going to search for the truth, you have to start looking elsewhere or at least enhancing it. You know, physics, I think, I'm not saying that physics and science is futile. I think it's very useful, but it is a mistake to become close-minded about it and to judge, you know, other ways of looking at the reality as being, you know, subjective and religious and not worthy of you know, scientific consideration. I'm sorry, that was a long-winded answer, but anyway.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you for taking time to give that answer, because all parts of that were very clear for me. Thank you. I appreciate you focusing on a few things there, that in Western science, there is some line that's drawn between conscious and unconscious, or living and not living things. And it doesn't seem based on very much factual, that line. And also, you're pointing out that there are some things in our world, there's a lot of things in our world that we are believing in, but we have not actually seen. And that's strange in a way, especially when we have a field that says that it's very important, the field of science, that says it's very important to prove things, that it's not a belief system. But you're pointing out, as others have, sometimes called scientism. I like that you have made this little phrase, the theology of matter. And, you know, another thing you just mentioned that's interesting is, I think the West and science, of course, has a lot of difficulty with embracing mystery and just saying we don't know. And they're always trying to say we know and we can prove it. And it seems like a problem that science gets stuck in. And, you know, I think also of my 3-year-old little boy who sees the trees moving outside, and it's the trees are moving because the wind is blowing the trees. And I try to explain to him what the wind is, and all I can explain are the results that the wind has on other things. And it seems that there's a lot of elements in our world that we've only seen the results, and we haven't actually seen those particular things.
Yes, yeah. sometimes when I talk about these things, people, scientists who are career scientists, they feel a little uneasy and they think I'm anti-science, but actually it's the opposite. I have tremendous respect for science. It's just that my research into this whole area, I have discovered some truths, which is what I'm trying to share, in this tour and share with you. That there is, for example, let's look at the environment. It's in, we all know, we don't need to talk about that, how bad the state is, in terms of the environment and many other, like social breakdown of families, breakdown of many values, depression is on a high, etc. In the modern civilization, the modern world, and I'm including India in that because, Delhi and Mumbai and Bangalore and all these Indian cities, they don't have a different paradigm from the West. It's the same worldview. But this modern scientific materialistic paradigm is basically, a Western scientific paradigm, And it is a good paradigm, but there are some, dark sides to it, which, Carl Jung said that every human being has a shadow side. And intelligent people are the ones who become aware of it and try to do something about it. And there is a dark side to science also, and it's just that I'm trying to bring to light. I'm not trying to trash all of science, but this thing that you mentioned, that the schism between living and non-living, the schism between man and nature, the vast majority of scientists today are, I would say, they don't really have any particularly strong religious affiliations. I mean, science is their religion, especially physicists. Most of the physicists that I meet, they wouldn't go to church or a temple, even the Indian physicists, I mean, they, matter is their god, and science is their religion. But unknown to them, Western science stands on a subconscious matrix of Christian theology, because the founding fathers of Western science, if you read the history of science and look at the scientific revolution, you read the writings of Francis Bacon, who was very, very important, and René Descartes and Galileo and Newton and all these people, they were, devout Catholics. And so, unfortunately, when the scientific revolution happened in the 1700s, a great opportunity was lost. The scientific revolution came as a response to, oppression by religious authorities and, to control of, all intellectual commerce by the religious authorities. So Western science came as a reaction to that, and they tried to free, the free-thinking people got together and created this thing called the scientific revolution. But because they were all, ingrained, deeply ingrained in Christian theology, the idea of the Old Testament that, actually it's not just in the in Christian, but it's also in most of the monotheistic religions of the world, the idea that there is a schism between man and nature. Man is made in the image of God. You see, this is a very sort of fatal schism in Western consciousness that goes back to maybe 325 AD, But this has very serious consequences for almost all the problems that we are facing in all the spheres of life today, leading with the environment. But the schism between man and nature, man is supposed to be made in the image of nature and, in the image of God. And then there's the rest of creation, which is supposed to not have any spirit at all. And no other authority, nobody less than God himself, has given man the license to treat nature and earth as a resource for human consumption, if you read the book of Genesis. And so this kind of thinking, and in pre-Christian Europe, this was not true. In pre-Christian Europe, nature was sacred. When you stepped out of your house, whether you were in Norway or whether you were in whichever country, you just stepped out of your house and you stepped into your temple. Every tree had, a guiding spirit, a deva. Every brook, every river, every pond had a spirit. and you know, but later on, when organized religion, you know, took over, then all the sacredness was, you know, thousands of miles away in some Middle Eastern country. There was nothing there. There was nothing outside their home. There was no need to connect to the earth. So this kind of culture, and you know, existed for a long time, for many, many centuries, and concomitant with that, together with that, this very dangerous practice of killing, actually, or persecuting people who worship nature. You know, they were called pagans, they were called witches or devil worshippers, but anybody who worshipped a rock or a tree or a river, you know, stood to lose his life, you know. So this kind of bias against nature, not treating nature as sacred, treating the earth as a resource for human consumption, this should have ended with this birth of the scientific revolution. But unfortunately, this got carried over into science. And the way many scientists operate, and, you know, they are good people. They are not evil people. I myself am a scientist. But this, it's very subconscious. You know, it's this bias. You know, we are the gods. You know, the scientists are the gods of today, you know. And we feel any experiment that we want to devise, no matter what it costs, you know, whether it's exploding a nuclear device in the bottom of the ocean, complete disregard for the millions of life forms that are going to be destroyed. For the sake of science, for the sake of human progress, no amount of sacrifice of nature is considered wrong, you know. But the roots of this come from this idea that man is made in the image of God, and that, you know, there is no spirit in nature. Nature is not, you should not worship nature, you should not hold nature as sacred. And until this issue is addressed, you know, just counting the carbon credits and, you know, trying to recycle your plastic bags is not going to do it. You know, we have to fundamentally change, actually, the way we look at nature and, of course, the way we look at ourselves, you know. So this is the essence, I mean, because we don't have a lot of time, so this is actually what I just told you is the essence of my work on spiritual ecology. And it all sounds very depressing and negative, I know, but the good side, the good news is that I have been blessed to discover living models, you know, of sustainability in the Indian villages, you know, in the Himalayas. One of my favorite hobbies is to go to these villages in the Himalayas, which are far removed from the main cities of India. And it's amazing that you see such a sophisticated mode of existence. You see these people who have existed for thousands of years without trashing their environment, you know, and without the need to, you know, get up and go and conquer other lands because they have used up all their resources. They just live in complete harmony with their environment. And at the reason they do that is they love and respect and revere nature, you know. And of course, so the questions that I've been asking is what is it that these illiterate, uneducated villagers know that people in, you know, London and Mumbai and Delhi and Bangalore and Washington and Tokyo can learn? And there are many, many things. But the main thing is that the village Indian way of life is actually a very sophisticated mode of existence. And this way of life evolved not to maximize material wealth and comfort and money and power and, you know, sensory indulgences. It evolved to maximize spiritual growth and loving connections between families and between friends, you know. The culture, the material wealth and prosperity came as a welcome byproduct of this. But the main focus was the fact that, you know, the main purpose of life is evolution of consciousness. The whole culture was arranged around this. And this, the key to this is the worldview of the rishis. The village Indian way of life is a gift of the rishis of India. You know, it didn't just happen by, accident. It is a clever design, a social engineering, you can say, of the rishis of India, who, and their worldview, in the rishis' worldview, in their paradigm, not dead matter, not some strings, quickly little worms hanging around in 10-dimensional space, being the supreme principle of creation, but consciousness. Consciousness is the supreme principle of creation. It is consciousness that condenses into mind, and it is mind that condenses into energy, and it is energy that condenses into matter. So the supreme principle of creation being consciousness, once consciousness has a form, it has a personality. So that's why the village people in India, they worship the rivers, the mountains, the lakes, the rocks, the trees, because everything is conscious and everything has a personality. That's why you have Mother Ganga, Mother Jamuna. It is not some tribal, you know, polytheism. People don't understand how sophisticated this worldview is. And so, you know, all the gods and goddesses, which pre-Christian Europe also had, but which they lost, unfortunately, the gods and goddesses in the Vedic worldview are anthropomorphic representations of cosmic forces, you know. And that's why in the Vedic worldview, nature is there breathing down your neck in every book, every poem, every song, every ritual, every act, the most simple act of your, like brushing your teeth, for example, or cooking your meal. Nothing is devoid of nature and the sacredness of nature and expressing your gratitude for it. If you look at the Vedic hymns, in almost every line, when they pray, you know, a Vedic hymn will be praying to the sun, you know, or to Mitra, the god, or the wind god, you know, for prosperity, for health, for guidance, for protection. They always include the four-legged and the two-legged and the trees and the herbs, you know. They will always include the animals, you know. So to cut a long story short, my hope and wish, and in my own small way, the thing that I'm working for, is to bring about a shift in the paradigm of the modern world. And I don't care, I'm not saying that they all have to become Hindus or that they have to start, you know, living in caves and worshipping trees. I don't care what people believe in, but this I know, the sacredness of nature, the absolute inviolable sacredness of nature, nature being the mother, the earth being the mother, that has to be a part of it. That has to be a part of everything, our, you know, the politics, the economics, everything. So, anyway.
Thank you.
Yeah.
My name is John Malkin, and this is The Great Leap Forward. I'm speaking this evening with Krishnakant Shukla, and he writes about spiritual ecology and speaks about these topics. And he also plays music, devotional music from India. Check out his website, which is krishnakantshukla.com, and that's KrishnakantShukla. And Krishnakant, tell me a little more about your times in Indian villages. You've spent a lot of time the past 15 years in Indian villages, and you're talking about that a bit, what you've learned and what you are offering out to other areas of the planet about what you've learned. You've already spoken, touched on a number of things. One thing that you've written about is that you would like to steer mankind away from its present lemmings-like march into a dark abyss worse than death. And in the United States, I observe that this society is so focused on material wealth and comfort, and that it is, as you put it, a socially designed mechanism. People have become consumers and observers rather than participants with each other, with nature, with their own lives. Tell me what you've seen coming from Indian villages. What have you seen when you come to the United States?
Basically, I was going to the villages to study their music. Now, there are many people who go to the Indian villages, you know, politicians, doctors, you know, health workers and social workers. But they're always coming there, you know, to give something to them and to, so, quote-unquote, uplift them, and to, quote-unquote, help them, you know. But I was going there as a beggar to ask them to teach me their music. I was going with a little recording Walkman. And because because of that, because I was not going from some superior point of view, but I was coming there, you know, as a beggar, they would let their hair down. And then initially I was, you know, just my plan was to record the music, but I began to realize that they have so much beauty and so much humanity, and there is so much that modern humans can learn. And there are very beautiful incidents. Maybe I should relate like a small incident that that was like an aha experience for me. You know, this is a small tribal village called Devipuram in Andhra Pradesh, where I had gone with a couple of my American friends. And it was very hot, and it was near the forest, you know, the tribal forest were close by. And there was a tribal lady selling green coconuts on this, you know, on the side of the road. She had probably just gone into the forest and picked some coconuts, you know, and brought them to sell. And like a lot of these tribal people, you know, you could see that she is economically very poor. She was wearing very clean clothes, but they were torn. Her sari was torn. But she had that dignity and that glow in the eyes, you know, that that you often see in, you know, in these people, and a very relaxed attitude and a beautiful, sweet smile. So I went to her and I said, "Can you give me a coconut?" And she picked it up. She was very sort of iffy about it. She picked it up, she put it down, picked it up, put it down, and then she said, "I'm sorry, I can't sell you this coconut." So I said, "I'll give you money. You know, I mean, do you think that I'm just going to walk away or something?" I showed her the money. I said, "Just give us three coconuts." And she said, she picked it up, she put it down. Then again, she said, "I'm sorry, just please buy it from somewhere else." So then I asked her, "Why are you doing this when I'm offering you the money? You know, I'm not haggling with you about the price, and, you know, I want your coconuts. Why aren't you selling them?" Then she just smiled and she said, "Look, I'm sorry, I should have explained. You see, what happened was that before you, one customer after another, they came, you know, in the last half an hour, and they bought coconuts from me. Now you see that other lady sitting over there, you know, about 20 yards from her, there was another woman with a similar shop on the ground, you know, of coconuts. So she said, you know, that lady should also sell some coconuts, right? I mean, it's not good otherwise. So you please go and buy from her, you know." And as I walked away from her, I had a realization that this woman, this has a principle. She has something. She knows something that the professors of economics in London School of Economics and Delhi School of Economics and Harvard School of Economics don't know. You know, that if we can put this into the equations, what this woman has just done, this poor illiterate Indian woman, you know, for her, profit is not an absolute god. The GNP, or, you know, the upward flow of the chart, you know, that is not an absolute goal. She put human feelings, and she had a code of honor, you know, in her business. And this is one of the many, many problems. This is one of the things that modern human beings can learn, you know, from the modern world, because we have destroyed our gods, we've destroyed our mythology, but we still have gods. You know, we make, you know, profit into a god and many other things that shouldn't be a god. Another example, I was roaming around in the villages in the Himalayas, and there was a goat herd, a man who had these beautiful Himalayan goats. And he was, you know, and so I went to him and I said, "Can I buy some goat milk from you?" And he said, no, I don't sell the goat milk." But he had like 100 goats, you know, and I said, "You know, they look really good, and I'll give you a lot of money, you know. I know the level of reality in which they subsist." So I told him, "Look, I'll give you 50 rupees, which is a lot of money, you know. And I said, for just a little glass of the goat milk." And he said, no, sorry, you know, we just don't sell the goat milk." So I said, "Why? Do you have a very large family? Is that it?" He said, no, we don't drink the goat milk. We don't sell it. We just let it go to waste. You know, we just waste it. So I said, "Why do you do that? You know, it's goat milk, has so much nutrition." And he's, you know what he said? He said, "You know, we like to eat goat meat, you know, and we love to eat goat meat, and that's why we don't drink the goat milk." So I said, "Why not?" He said, "Well, the day we drink the milk of the goat, she becomes the mother. We will no longer, you know, eat her meat, you know." So this is another example of the many, many examples, and we don't have enough time for me to give you more stories, but they have a code of honor by which they will stand, and it doesn't matter if they lose a huge amount of money, but to them, their honor, the things that they honor, they honor and affirm their the things they believe in, and they live for that rather than the profit, you know. So like this, there are many, many examples, but it is actually, we are fortunate because, you know, the Aborigines were also there, but they are gone. You had the Yaquis and the Toltecs and the Incas, these beautiful civilizations, the Mayans and the Iroquois and the Onondagas, you know. They had all similar ideas. They, you know, pre-Christian Europe and the rest of the world was enveloped in a very harmonious worldview where nature was sacred. But that is what is missing. I am not saying that we have to trash our science and we have to look at our science and our scientists in contempt. What I am praying for and hoping for, and I don't have all the answers, is if we can find some way to infuse science with spirituality, you know. I'm working for the day when a physicist and a biologist and a psychologist, you know, and an engineer and an economist will stand waist deep in the river and bow down to the sun. I'm looking forward to the day when physicists will step out of their house and hug a tree, you know. That's what I'm trying to point out, you know. So
those are beautiful images.
Yeah.
And thank you for the stories. Krishna, in a short while, I'm going to play some of your music for people to hear. I'd love for you to tell us a little more about your music. The song that I'll be playing is called Bird from a Foreign Land. It's Ham Pardes Panchi Baba. Would you say a few words, and if you'd like, read the translation of that and tell us more about your music?
Sure. The songs that I sing, they belong to... some of them belong to a 600-year-old living oral tradition. They are songs of Kabir, who is one of my favorite poets. And the other song, the other group of songs that I sing go even before that. So it would be like almost a 1,400-year living oral tradition. And so these are, you know, I in this concert tour that I'm having in America for the past 2 months, I've driven across America from the East Coast to the West Coast. I've given about 17 concerts so far. There have been many incidents and many things have happened which have convinced me that these songs don't belong to me. They are not mine. I belong to these songs. You know, when you have a living oral tradition that is so old and so many generations of incredible people have put their life energy into it and have actually sort of merged into it, then it has a living kind of consciousness and a living energy of its own, you know, and it takes you where you want to go. Because I just came, initially I came from India for one particular concert that was organized in upstate New York by Meher Baba, you know, the Northeast Gathering of Meher Baba Lovers. But slowly, you know, I've, given many concerts. But anyway, these songs are, they basically transformed my life, and they have an incredible amount of, wisdom and beauty. And what I'm basically trying to do is, in my own small way, try to share this with people, you know, in this world. Because one of the many, many things that this world needs, we need less, we need more and more people to just sing and dance, you know. We don't have to just figure everything out in our heads. We should also have fun and sing, you know. So anyway, this song is one of my favorites, the one that you have selected. And it is by Kabir. And it's basically talking about the how the spirit feels in this material world, the feeling of longing, you know. So I'll just give you my own very non-scholarly translation of the song. It says, I am a bird from a foreign land. I do not belong to this land. In this land, people are asleep, unconscious, each moment a cosmic dissolution. The land where I come from, I could sing without a mouth, I could walk without feet, I could fly without wings. I had a shape without form, and I always lived in the heart, enjoying the cosmic unstruck melody. The land where I'm from, there was no light and dark, heat and cold, no dualities. My Lord and Master was beyond all dualities, and I was one with him. The land where I'm from, my meditation was unbroken, effortless, spontaneous, and continuous. I never lost that state where the mind and the prana cannot reach. That's where my true home lies, O brothers. My Lord and Master is formless, yet he takes on all names and all forms. Says Kabir, listen, brother seeker, my Lord lives within me. So this is the song.
Wonderful. Tell people how much longer you might be in the United States and what your plans are for your tour.
Well, I'm right now here in Berkeley in California, and I hope to fly. I have an open ticket. I hope to fly back to India sometime, you know, in January, maybe mid-January. I don't have a fixed date, and I am planning to actually drive back. I drove here all the way from upstate New York to California, and I am planning to drive back. It'll be a little cold, but I'm going to take my time. I'll probably take 3 weeks to drive back, giving concerts along the way. And, I'm trying to do here in America what the Indian fakirs and the wandering troubadours of India, especially the ones who belong to Gorakhnath and Kabir sects, you know, they have been doing this for hundreds of years, which is they would just go from village to village. They would not work for a living. They would not ask for any money for their songs. People would just take care of them, feed them, and give them some traveling expenses, and then they would move on to the next village. And so they just, you know, this is what they do all their life. So this is a scientific experiment that I'm doing. I just decided that I would come alone and just travel across America and see if I could just be a wandering, Indian troubadour in America. And so far, it's been very, very good, you know, and I'm totally overwhelmed with all the beauty that I've seen in this place and the number of beautiful people that I've met, you know. So basically, that's my plan, you know, to drive back across the country and then eventually fly back to the land where I'm from. Yeah.
Krishna Kant Shukla, I've had a really nice time speaking with you this evening. I'm really happy that our paths have crossed.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Me likewise.
And I wish you well, and I look forward to meeting you in person. That will be nice. Okay. Have a nice evening. I'm going to end now with Ham Pardes Panchi Baba.
Okay. So should I hang up now?
You can stay on the line there for just a moment.
Okay.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Here is Ham Pardes Panchi Baba, Bird from a Foreign Land, by Krishna Shukla.
पंची बाबा अनि देश रानाई हो हम परदेश पंची बाबा अनि देश
घट माई भाई संतो
संत